Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and 1 year ago today, Massachusetts confirmed its first case of COVID-19 in a UMass Boston student recently returned from China. Now that day, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health assured residents that, quote, the risk to the public from the 2019 novel coronavirus remains low in Massachusetts, end quote. Well, we want to spend the day today reflecting on that 1 year anniversary, and I was thinking about it this morning. 2 days after that first diagnosis, I got tested for the flu, which it turned out I had. And I remember before entering my room at the urgent care clinic where I went to get the test, the medical professional stopped at the door and asked me, "Have you recently been to China?" He came through the door after I said no, because at the time we were both assuming that that was all the screening we needed to ensure I wasn't carrying COVID-19, despite the fact that I had fever, fatigue, a cough. Well, what a difference a year makes. So today we have several members of Boston's medical community looking back on the year with us, mostly professionals we talked to early on. And we begin with two guests who we spoke with on April 7th, 2020. Now that was our first Radio Boston conversation about early signs that the coronavirus was having disproportionate impact on vulnerable populations and communities of color. Joining us are Dr. Joseph Betancourt, the Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer of Massachusetts General Hospital, and Michael Curry, who is CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the state's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group. Dr. Betancourt, Michael, welcome back to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So you heard me talk a little bit about what was on my mind this morning, thinking back a year to that first diagnosis in Massachusetts. Let me ask you the same things. Dr. Betancourt, what's on your mind on this 1 year anniversary?
Well, you know, it's interesting just to reflect on the fact that it was April 7th last year. Boy, what a difference a year makes, where the time goes. And I think as I just reflect back on that conversation, I would say that we predicted pretty much exactly what was going to happen. I recall talking about even then with Michael how communities of color were at highest risk. And here we are. It wasn't just locally, but it was nationally. And communities of color were hit hard. They were hit early. And they've been, you know, really devastated by this economically and otherwise, health-wise, and not just here in Boston, but around the country. And so I think it's been a real journey. It's been difficult. It's been challenging. It's been there's been a sense of urgency throughout. And we're nowhere near done. And even when we're done with COVID, the battle for equity continues. So those are just, you know, I think we're focused a lot on the vaccine now, but those are just some reflections from our last conversation to now.
Michael, how about your reflections?
Yeah, I would agree with Dr. Betancourt. You know, the past as prologue is always stuck in my mind, and that people like Dr. Betancourt and many other folks who do emergency preparedness have been warning us for such a day, right? We wish we should have been prepared this time last year, because we knew a pandemic was not a possibility, it was an inevitability. And people had warned us about how many would die. They had warned us about how overrun our emergency rooms would be, or the lack of PPE. All these things have been discussed. And I tell people, the most troubling hearing I've ever participated in my adult life of doing government relations work was a hearing at the State House, which I wouldn't be surprised if Dr. Betancourt was part of the panels, that really foreshadowed what would happen when we had our next pandemic. And it was terrifying. And then I think back to a year ago, that if we had just listened to the scientists, to the experts, how many more lives would we have saved? How much more PPE would we have had on hand? And how much better prepared overall we could have been? So that's what I think about, Tiziana, when I think back over the last year.
Are you angry, Michael?
No, not angry. I think I get disappointed in us, right? It's because whether it's, you know, Tiziana, as you and I have talked about the racial justice stuff that we're going through at the same time, that other pandemic, you know, these warnings, you know, people have been warning us of this stuff, have been trying to get our attention and pay attention. It's funny, Dr. Betancourt, I put on my social media page the other day, which applies to this pandemic as well. I said, I'm so glad that so many people are woke and others are waking up, but some of us are insomniacs. And the reality is, Dr. Betancourt's been an insomniac on this stuff of health equity and what this would mean too bad we didn't pay attention.
So, Dr. Betancourt, I mean, what Michael just said, that insomniac concept, that's never going to leave me, you know, not at the end of this pandemic, not in getting ready for the next one. Was there a moment, was there a sleepless night for you early on, Dr. Betancourt? Now I'm being literal with his metaphor there, where you sort of realized, oh, we have this wrong and this is going to be really, really bad, especially for vulnerable people.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, he too is an insomniac, and there's a lot of us who've been committed to this issue for a long time who really understand the urgency of this as it was evolving. You know, not to mention that, just to bring it into the mix, the murder of George Floyd, kind of as we were coming off our surge, to kind of further add kind of insult to injury and further kind of highlight all the issues that we've been talking about. And so it really just, I think everything was so magnified. I think for me, there was a couple of key moments. Early on, certainly, you know, very, very early on, I mean, getting the dispatches from Italy, just from a general standpoint, as we were seeing healthcare professionals over there describe what was happening. That's when it hit me. I said, you know, this isn't, you know, these aren't dispatches from a third world or unknown country. I was able to see very visually what was happening. And that's when I literally got on, you know, text and email to friends to say, hey, you know, this is real. We need to, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I think the second was, you know, not shortly after our conversation, as we saw how this was growing, we understood that our ability to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 wasn't about you know, ICU capacity or beds. This is really about what we were able to do at people's doorstep in the community. And, you know, people like Michael and others have been working around community health for all this, you know, for decades, for forever. And we've been talking about the importance of community health. And I think this pandemic really illustrated fundamentally that public health, community health is essential. Those kind of, you know, upstream interventions prevent the downstream impacts of being overwhelmed inside our hospitals. And there was a lot of sleepless nights around how are we going to mobilize quickly to, you know, put this fire out or slow its spread in communities, in these hotspot communities. And I guess the last, you know, what's created a lot of sleepless nights for me as a caregiver is having, you know, served on the surge teams is just seeing people suffer and seeing people die alone and seeing, you know, the pain. It's real. And I think it's been that much more difficult as this has been, you know, over the year politicized and called a hoax. And, you know, I often tell people, I just wish I could download a little bit of my memory and what I've seen to you so you could understand this as we kind of heard these rumors running rampant.
So before I turn back to Michael, let me see if I can actually help you download a little of your memory. Is there a particular patient or a particular case that is staying with you that you could share with us?
Yeah, you know, we stood up an effort here at Mass General, which I'm very proud of, right? So very quickly we realized that as we were tracking our COVID positive patients early on, that up to 30 to 40% were Spanish-speaking, outstripping the supply of our interpreters who could no longer be with us live. And because we were trying to preserve PPE, we're virtual. And so we stood up something called the Spanish Language Care Group. We did a call to action. 50 native Spanish-speaking doctors basically agreed to cover the hospital 24/7, 7 during the day, 4 at night, really kind of providing and making sure that there was clinical, cultural, and linguistic competence and a Spanish-speaking doctor at every instance. And I think for me, you know, there was a patient that I remember seeing, and it's kind of cuts both ways. It's the joy and the pain. The joy of walking into that room and having that patient hear me speak Spanish and just his face light up to understand, wow, there's a Spanish-speaking doctor here, because we are, you know, doctors of color are few and far between, but to have that and to know that we are here to serve you, you know, to see his joy, but then quickly to see his pain as we were kind of working with him to prevent him from getting intubated and kind of coaching him to try to kind of lie on his stomach, and that was difficult for him because he had a pacemaker. I mean, you know, it brought so many things to mind. You know, I could communicate in his language, but it really was a team of people doing everything they could to care for him. You know, the pain he was under and how tenuous he was. And it was, you know, shortly thereafter where, you know, he started to take a turn. But those memories, I think, stick with you for a lifetime, and they're things that we won't forget, and they drive us. They drive us to try to grab as much ground as we can right now during this time, and to not have a short memory, and to have a courage to not have a short memory about what we've all experienced, to make a better healthcare system and better and deeper investments in community health and public health.
Thank you for sharing that story, actually. You know, it really does help it come home for those of us who have not been on the front lines and haven't seen what you've seen. Michael, a minute ago, you expressed some frustration that there was testimony, there was information we had before this pandemic struck that had we listened and paid attention, we could have done differently. And it makes me think about the moment we're in now, where we are now hearing about inequitable access to vaccines, whether that's where the centers are being stood up or the pace at which it's rolling out. You know, I know you were on the advisory group. You are on the governor's COVID vaccine advisory group. When did that planning start in earnest? And, you know, were people listening about equity and access issues from the beginning in that planning?
Yeah, I think, you know, first and foremost, credit to the governor for he and his many colleagues across the country put together these working groups, I think at the advice of the CDC, and chose an excellent leader in Paul Bettinger to lead it. Paul, from day one, maybe 6-7 months ago, we started meeting and discussing a prioritization strategy. Paul's always been receptive to the issue of equity. So you have folks like myself on that task force, both in the role that I have here at the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, but in my racial justice work. You have Liz Walker, who's been a champion right there in Roxbury for the patients and the communities and the folks who are attendees of her church. You have Dr. McLean at MGH and many others, even our new head of the CDC, Ms. Walensky, Dr. Walensky, was part of this effort. Everyone embraced the notion of equity. Now, you know, part of the challenge when you have a group is to figure out what equity looks like, right? How do you prioritize groups? Who goes up? In what order? And that was really the work of that group. I never, not at any point, felt that there wasn't a shared commitment to equity. But the challenge, again, is to figure out how to do it. So I say that to say, Tiziana, the process was good. Where we often fall down in the work of equity is in the implementation. And we're seeing that across the country. Here in Massachusetts, we prioritize some groups. One, healthcare workers like Dr. Betancourt and the others that are on the front line, because we know we need them to be here, available, healthy, to respond to this pandemic for the months to come, including our many community health center leaders, our long-term care providers, our homeless shelter leaders and their patients, the participants, and many other areas that need to be on the front lines. And then when you get to phase two, which we started today, that older population, which are dying at a disparate rate, they're higher, older Americans that are sick and dying. Where the equity falls apart is that we don't identify some of the challenges with age populations. So 75 and older, though we're starting there today, is a little bit more weighted to white communities because of life expectancy. So one of the things we tried to get to quickly in our process was comorbidities and younger age groups, 60, 65 and older, to offset the age groups that are predominantly white. Those are the kind of discussions and challenges and nuances that we had to get into in the task force. And I'm just hoping that on the implementation side, we can do better as we roll out this vaccine. If we do not, we will see this disease born differently on Black and Brown folks than it will on white Massachusetts residents or white Bostonians.
So I was struck by that list you just gave, Michael. Everybody but Wanda McLean are people we've spoken with in the last several months about this this pandemic and about vaccinations. And that, you know, Boston is the heartbeat of a lot of medical advancement. We're going to talk with Dr. Dan Baruch later, who helped advance the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It makes me think, Dr. Betancourt, so Rochelle Walensky's now at the CDC in Washington. Is the change there and the talent that this new administration has brought going to make a difference for us, a practical difference for us here on the ground in Massachusetts?
Without question. I mean, I think we need to understand that the challenges that we face at the state level really stem from a lack of any viable federal plan. The fact that Rochelle Walensky, who's a friend who I know cares deeply about this work, arrives at the CDC and is unable to even inventory her stockpile of vaccination tells you that there's a big problem. And so when you have states having a lot of uncertainty about, you know, what and when their vaccine supply will be, then from a trickle-down standpoint of how we get needles into arms and in how we engage healthcare systems, health centers, community-based organizations to mobilize this effort, you know, that variable is so big that it becomes nearly impossible to plan. So it's no excuses. It's just reality. And, I've been pleased to know that there's no shortage of I think, leaders with great intentions. But, you know, we're playing with a deck of cards that's just very, very challenging right now. And it does require that people have patience. And I know that's probably the hardest thing to do. This pandemic's been going on for a long time. But ultimately, I do believe that with this new leadership, with Dr. Walensky's leadership and the new administration really focused on deployment and leveraging resources and helping the states who are struggling, and the states then being able to help us, I think we're up for a much better opportunity to make progress, hopefully in the weeks to come, but certainly in the months to come.
And Tiziana,
all right, and Michael, yep. Yes.
One quick point. I just want to reinforce this. I said this at the governor's press conference, but I want to restate this. Thank God for the advocates. I've been an advocate. Secretary Sutters was an advocate before she joined the administration. Dr. Betancourt has been in that role. People need to ask critical questions and hold everyone accountable, because we all need to answer those questions. So if you're asking about equity, don't stop. If you're asking about resourcing and getting doses into communities of color, don't stop. Ask the critical questions and force the rest of us to answer it.
All right. And that is Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Michael, I know you're going to stay with us a little longer in the show. So I also want to thank Dr. Joseph Betancourt, the Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer of Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Betancourt, I know we're saying goodbye to you. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for the time. And it's always a pleasure to be on with Michael. So I thank you and wish you all the best.